Hello, and welcome to the new Shadow Politics. We're starting a new year. This is Senator Michael Brown, recently retired. So I'm coming to you live from Washington, D.C., with my new guest host, Liberty Jones, a college student who we'll introduce in a moment. And today we have a special guest. We have William Doyle, who's joining us from Helsinki, which is just amazing to me. Love technology. Mr. Doyle, thanks so much for being on the show. And let me tell you a little bit about him. He's an award-winning New York Times best-selling author who wrote about President Carter in his presidential history inside the Oval Office, for which he interviewed senior Carter administration officials and reviewed thousands of pages of White House files at the Carter Presidential Library. A longtime New Yorker, he joins us from Helsinki, Finland. Thank you so much for being with us. We want to talk about President Carter because I went to his funeral yesterday and my new co-host joined me, and she's going to chime in and tell us what she thought, what her impression is. And just let me tell you, as we start this new show, you folks have known that people that listen regularly know that I've had three co-hosts so far. And I've tried to mix it up. I've had Republican co-hosts, and now I've got a co-host who, and this is so hard for me to say because it hurts every time I say it, is 50 years younger than I am. And I absolutely believe in the principle that, you know, Albert Einstein taught us that what you see depends on where you stand juxtaposed to what you look at. I assume that a 21-year-old sees things much different than I do. So I hope she'll bring a new perspective to the show, and we'll be able to make what has been a good show, even nominated for a People's Choice Award, an even better show. So first, let me welcome Mr. Doyle and also Liberty Jones, our new correspondent and co-host. Welcome, guys. Thanks for coming to the show, for being on the show.
Mr. Hi, Doyle. Senator Brown. Senator, and hi, Liberty. It's great to be with you.
It's great to be with you. And can we start, before Liberty chimes in, can we start by asking you about, both of us went to the Carter funeral yesterday, and among other things, we heard Stu Eisenstadt, who was the domestic policy advisor, as you well know, to President Carter, talk about his accomplishments. So can we start by talking about some of his accomplishments?
Sure. Jimmy Carter, in my opinion, was the perfect president at the time he became president, and because he was really inheriting the ruins of a wrecked presidency. John Kennedy was killed. Lyndon Johnson fled from the office in the horrors of Vietnam. Richard Nixon kind of ejected himself from the Oval Office. Jerry Ford was in office for about 10 minutes and accomplished very little just because of the shortness of his tenure. A decent man, certainly. Carter was basically there as a technician. I think the American people wanted stability. They wanted somebody new, somebody very smart. And Carter fit the bill perfectly because he was one of the smartest presidents we ever had. He was a breath of fresh air. He promised honesty and integrity, and he delivered it. And in a sense, he was, you know, some people, Senator and Liberty, they talk about Carter being a bad communicator. And I think that, or not being able to persuade and lead and inspire the public, but that's really only in retroactively in comparison to who followed him. Reagan, of course, being a master on the level of a John Kennedy or a Franklin Roosevelt at doing those things. So when he ran for office in 1976, he was a spectacular communicator, and he kept many of his promises. He was not perfect. He made mistakes, and he'll be the first one to tell you what some of his biggest mistakes were, and we can talk about that later. But I think in the end, what did he do? He stabilized the presidency. He was tough with the Russians. He launched a defense buildup that Reagan accelerated in response to Russian aggression. He deregulated multiple industries, which benefited the American people. He put human rights on the agenda, although actually that happened 2 years earlier in a building. I live in Helsinki, Finland at the moment, and across the street from me is the Finlandia Hall, the great hall where Gerry Ford and Leonid Brezhnev and, you know, a dozen other world leaders codified for the first time human rights on the international agenda, you know, beyond the United Nations. So Carter was fascinating in so many ways, and I'm just thrilled that you were able to be there and see the not only honoring of Carter, but the kind of the Woodstock of American political history and leadership right now. That must have been an amazing experience for the two of you.
Yeah, it was. And before I ask Liberty to join in right here, I want to ask you, the initial description you gave of Jimmy Carter, couldn't you have said the same thing about Joe Biden?
I think Biden.
We elected him for stability.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, they were. Biden's career started at the same time Carter's did, in a sense. And they had a relationship. Biden had a relationship with Richard Nixon. That's how far back he goes. I got my own start as a college student in working inside the U.S. Senate. For New York Senator James Buckley. I was a, you know, 10th level down intern. And
you and me both.
Years ago, yeah. And I, you know, I loved the experience. It was just a dream for somebody who likes politics and history. And I went back to the Senate 2 years ago to write a book about bipartisanship and the relationship between Orrin Hatch and Ted Kennedy and the great things that they accomplished together on a bipartisan level. And, you know, some people say that Carter was an era from the distant past in terms of decency, integrity, and, you know, paying attention to the technical aspects of the presidency, not just the politics. But I think he's a vision of the future. He's one part of the future. Because we will get back, I think, if we elect the right people, to a political world in America where bipartisanship, progress on issues from a practical point of view is the dominant thrust of things. And ideology or what do they call it, anger sphere or the the anger of social media might pass, and we can get back to doing what's great, what makes America great, which is admitting mistakes, tackling big issues, and making the world a better place. There's nobody can do that as well as America does, and I think we're ready to look in that direction, which was very much a direction Jimmy Carter tried to put forward, and I think Camp David, for example, is a good example of that. You know, like Nixon going to China and Carter somehow getting Egypt and Israel to sit down at a table and do a huge peace treaty. That's the kind of thinking and progress we need in America.
Well, since we have an expert on social media on with us, Liberty Jones, do you have anything you want to ask Mr. Doyle at this point, or that you want to anything you want to add?
Hi, Mr. Doyle. First, I wanted to say that thank you guys so much for having me on the podcast today. I'm so excited to join in on this conversation and with you two wonderful guests. And I just wanted to say that I think it's really interesting that you bring up that Jimmy Carter was a reflection of lost American values, because I feel like even when we're contrasting with Trump nowadays, you know, his presidency saw a huge retrenchment on these civil rights rhetorics that were so important during President Carter's time in office. And I just think that, you know, we say that we study history so that we don't repeat our mistakes, but really, how can we come back? You know, for talking to two people who were there during the peak of that era and of that movement of unity between everyone, where now we're just talking about division. How do we come back to a space like that, especially electing someone like that in office?
Yeah, great question.
Liberty, Yeah, that's really a great question. And when I went through the files at the Carter Library, I think, what I discovered was I would find myself smiling, laughing out loud, and being very puzzled sometimes because Jimmy Carter was madly in love with detail and incredible amounts of detail. And I was stunned. He was getting into the barbershop, the tennis court, the newspaper and magazine subscriptions in the White House building he poked his nose into. It's just amazing. But there were moments when I wanted to stand up and cheer. And one of them talks about what you just mentioned, civil rights. In the first 90 days of his administration, he reviewed every single federal appointment of any significance, lists of people being appointed to the federal government, and he would write on the margins of the memos things like, "Why don't we have any? Where are the women? Where are the women on this list? Where are the Hispanics and the black people, the black Americans? Where are they? Why don't you put any on this list?" So he was approaching it from a logical, very American way of practically looking at the list and looking at the nation and saying, why don't we look like the nation? Not necessarily through legally imposed quotas or angry rhetoric, but just practical reality. And I thought that was in 1977 he was doing this. Remember, the Civil Rights Act was only 12 years before that, and the Voting Rights Act. So he was doing this way ahead of his time, and in a very aggressive way. He appointed more people of color and women to the judiciary and to the federal government by far than any president before, and to a large extent for a number of years after since that. So that's one of the very inspiring things that he did. He also didn't like politics much. He liked technical details of issues and fixing them, but he didn't like. He thought politics was sinful, according to his own vice president, Walter Mondale. Walter Mondale said that Carter used to drive us in the White House nuts because we couldn't get him to focus on the politics of an issue. He only wanted to talk about the merits, the technical aspects, the administrative aspects, and getting things done. And I think that's a huge insight that maybe we can all learn from to make our system more effective and more productive for all Americans. So he was a politician who hated politics, which is a bit of a paradox.
That's a very interesting point you bring up. And Senator Brown, I think you're muted, if you'd like to add anything.
This is why we have a young person on the show, so that she can tell the old geezer when, you know, turn your mic on, Senator. Thank you. Thank you, Liberty. You've already worth your weight in gold. But yeah, what I wanted to add was that politics is sinful, and we've seen it raise its ugly head lately. You know, you talk about how he wanted diversity, and I'm listening to CNN tell us, as the Fox News people are saying, that DEI has led to the fires in California. I mean, it's just horrible what politics has come to lately. And I think that's one, and I'd like your opinion on this, but I think that Liberty and I saw an outpouring of love for this man over the last several days here in Washington, not only at the funeral, but people that waited in line for hours to give their, in the freezing cold, to say their goodbyes because of what politics has become. I think we yearn for a time when we had a decent man in the White House, and the contrast between the man we just elected and the man who Jimmy Carter was as a person, not as a politician, but as a person, I think has really added to all the outpouring of love for this man. What do you think about that? You think that's true?
Well, I think I really agree with a lot of that. And I think that I want to tell you a story about Camp David that very few people know or understand. Camp David is widely accepted and understood as a triumph of personal negotiation and of historic bringing Israel and Egypt together. Now, the reality is that Dick Nixon and Gerry Ford had already pushed that momentum forward with Yitzhak Rabin before Carter in the Sinai 1 and 2 disengagement accords, which basically froze the conflict between Israel and Egypt in 1974-75. So that's one part of the reality. But let me tell you about Jimmy Carter's modesty and humility and decency, which actually hurt him at Camp David. He took Sadat and Begin in a 13-day grueling negotiation. Carter and Begin hated each other so much that on day three, they would not talk to each other, and they stayed in their cabins and had intermediaries, including Carter, walk back and forth to their cabins. On day 11, Carter, with rarely meeting the three of them at the same time, Carter, at one point, Sadat said, "I'm leaving. This is crazy. I'm leaving." And he ordered the helicopter, and the rotors were spinning. And Jimmy Carter ran over to Sadat's cottage, got on his knees, and prayed with Sadat, begging him to stay and promising he would do his best to break the logjam. Sadat stayed, and at the last second, Senator and Libby, Jimmy Carter thought he had a deal where Begin, the Israeli prime minister, said, "I agree, Menachem Begin, to an indefinite freeze by Israel on settlements in annexed and occupied land." And Carter did not want tape recorders in the meeting. He didn't even want note takers because he thought this is a measure of his decency. He thought that he could take notes and trust these guys to, you know, to honor what they said. And according to Carter and according to Sadat, Begin double-crossed them at the last second after the deal was announced by sending a follow-up letter saying, "No, no, no, I didn't agree to a 90-day freeze, to an indefinite freeze. I agreed to a 90-day freeze pending the finalization of a treaty between Israel and Egypt." In other words, fudging and fumbling the entire issue of Palestine, there were, at that moment, there were 25,000 Israeli settlers on annexed and occupied land. Today, there are 700,000. Regardless of what you think about that issue, it shows you how Carter's wanting to be decent caused this problem in the negotiations and basically a poison pill in the Camp David negotiations. But it also, Senator and Liberty, do you know who tells that story? It was Jimmy Carter, and it was Jimmy Carter in his own, I think, humble and honest way of self-criticism who acknowledged that that mistake was a big, big mistake, and it kind of, you know, plagued the Middle East for the last 40, 50, 60 years.
Yeah.
So I mentioned this as an illustration of his personality, which is very, very admirable, but in politics can sometimes get you into trouble.
Well, let's talk about some of the other failures. Yes, absolutely. And we've certainly seen that. And it was an extension of what, you know, the 1949, accords, right, where we created Israel. Was it 48 or 49, whenever that was. But let's talk about some of the other things. Recently, we've heard our new president-elect say that the Panama Canal was one of his failures. Do you think that was a failure?
Well, this is mind-boggling. And the discussion of Greenland, which is a place I've been to and loved. I spent 2-3 weeks there writing a magazine article. I'm just flabbergasted, and I don't think I can develop an opinion on this because it's so bizarre. But if President-elect Trump's strategy is to if he may be thinking way ahead of me, he may be doing, you know, five-dimensional chess. He may be saying, okay, this is a way of provoking European nations like Denmark to spend more on defense and freeze out Chinese influence from Greenland or Panama. This is a way of checkmating China out of influence in the canal zone because there's a strategic threat of it being closed if China controls too many port facilities. If that's what Trump is doing, then he's a heck of a lot smarter than any president I've heard of. But if it's just like a throwaway line to be chaotic or to be to mix things up on the international stage, I'm just flabbergasted to the point of not having an opinion, which rarely happens with me. So I have no idea. The Panama Canal Treaty was supported by Bill Buckley and a whole wide range of conservatives at the time. Ronald Reagan opposed it. It was, you know, honest minds can disagree on how it was negotiated, but it's sovereign territory, and the United States of America never conquers and occupies foreign territory. That rarely happens. So I don't know where that's going to go. I'm right now in the Baltic, 20 miles south of me. Russia is, seems to have torn up the communications cables with between this country and Estonia. And just today, there were some very strange nautical maneuvers by Russian submarines chasing and shadowing Finnish, NATO, essentially, craft on the high seas of the Baltic. So it's a very strange time. But I think that the more we look at Carter's presidency and his mistakes, Senator, like you said, I think Jimmy Carter would be the first to tell us, study my mistakes and learn from them. And that's something we should do with every president and president-elect.
Well, I before I let Liberty weigh in again, let me just say that I told her this yesterday, I think, as I was walking around, there were military people everywhere, paying honor, of course, to the former president. And I was so tempted to say to one of them, are you guys ready to invade Greenland? Because it's such a ridiculous concept, isn't it, that we may even use military force? I mean, it's crazy. But Liberty, go ahead. Do you have anything else you want to add?
Yeah. So, I think it's really interesting how you say your first and really your only reaction you can grasp now is, wow, I'm so flabbergasted. Because I think that really reflects on the change of politics, we've seen. Like you were talking about how in the first 90 days of his appointment, he just reviewed the details, specific inquiries, and he wasn't focused on the politics or the face of it all. He was focusing on genuinely helping the American people. And I think that nowadays, especially through social media, it's become such a deep, power-hungry facade that a lot of these celebrities are playing. Trump is a celebrity at the end of the day. And it's like the more shocking his content is, the more the media is going to engage with it and the more power he's going to gain from that. And I just think it's really interesting how he strays away completely from the detail-oriented, the technical fixing the issue systems that Jimmy Carter had in place, because he has completely different motives and it's reflected in me.
Yeah, now you understand why I asked her to join the show, because you're absolutely
that
right.
That is a brilliant, brilliant analysis. That shock creates power in the media, bloodstream, to mix some metaphors. But that's very, very true. But I think that there's a flip side to that coin. Jimmy Carter came out of almost nowhere and became president, writing basically the television medium. Barack Obama came out of pretty much nowhere, 2 years as a senator and not much, executive experience before that. He stood up and he started talking. And he talked his way into, again, probably mostly on television. There was some social media. And Donald Trump he came from multiple business failures and a cheesy TV reality show, which was entertaining and fun, stood up and started talking in the angry shock, us versus them way, and became president. So what I think is that social media and television and our political system can be exploited for good and for positive results. And maybe in 3 or 4 years, we'll have a new president who does that in a very positive and productive direction, which just uses these tools and social media and anger. I'm angry. I hate disease, poverty, oppression, a whole host of issues. I hate them. Let's be real about this. There are Nazis in the United States of America. There are terrorists. There are Marxists who may want to overthrow the government. And I hate that, you know, possibility, but there are only like a couple hundred of each of those, or maybe, I don't know, 1,500 maximum. And the rest of us are not demons or devils, but social media has turned us into that, to hate each other. And that's crazy. And someone has to come along and snap us out of that. And I think we're ready for it. And it can be done pretty quickly, I think. I don't know what you think. I don't know if this is all irrevocable negativity, but I think the tools you were talking about, Justice, may actually create a good result soon.
Well, given what she just said, given what Liberty just said, and given what you said about Carter, and one of the reasons that I want her on the show is to get this different perspective, but are we victims of what you said about Carter, that we're worried about being the good guy, we're worried about being the stand-up, so we've ignored what Liberty is talking about, and we're trying to, you know, we're trying to take the high road, right? We talked about democracy. We didn't talk about people eating our dogs and cats and people sneaking into the country. 10 million people. I really want to know how many Italians came in when my grandparents came in, or how many Irish came in. I think there were more than 10 million. But have we hoisted ourselves on our own petard, as Shakespeare would say, by trying to be the good guys?
Great question. I think that we all have become prisoners of rhetoric and of repeated lies and of repeated vocabulary. For example, you know, if you may share this with me, both of you might, I don't know, but if I hear the words CRT, DEI, political correctness, any of these phrases anymore, I'm going to be really angry. Like, that's what I'm angry at, is the fact that this never seems to change. What we need is an entire, I'll give you an example, the abortion issue, for example, which was a very hot button issue. It has been for decades. Briefly, in the United States of America, there was a movement in the Midwest where a man who was a Trump labor secretary nominee got together with an abortion director. I think it was in St. Louis, the administrator of an abortion clinic. The two of them got together, with the first, the gentleman being a Catholic anti-abortion activist. Two of them got together and said, look, what can we agree on? We hate, you know, we hate the fact that women have to endure this, or that, you know, some of us, half the country, or 20% think that these are human beings who should be untouched, and, you know, and so on and so forth. Complex issue, but what can we agree on? Maybe we can agree on birth control, regardless of what the Catholic Church or other, you know, churches' official position might be, and we can agree on prenatal and postnatal care that's good and available for all, you know, income groups. Let's get together and do common ground on abortion. That movement started in the 1980s, and it caught on, and then it stopped. I don't know why, but it was a beautiful example of how, even in the most emotional kind of issue, if you have leaders like these two Midwestern neighbors, if you have enough of them and we stay with it, we can get together and solve these issues. I know we can, and we'll never do it by hating each other or lying about things. But Senator, I think the key to this is we have to break out of the vocabulary and the traps that we're in, and the traps of hating other Americans. We have to declare, as Orrin Hatch said, we need a Geneva Convention on communications and on social media and on political discourse. We agree on certain minimums, and I think one of the minimums has got to be you're not the enemy, you're not the devil. You know, unless you prove that you are in a court of law and you're caught, you know, you're convicted of that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And all you have to do to get out of it is get elected president, and then you don't have to go to jail. But what you say is so true. I mean, I remember campaigning for John Kerry. I did it in Minnesota on Indian Reservation. And I had a young woman say, come up to me and say, I can't vote for him because he's pro-abortion. And I said, don't be ridiculous. Nobody is pro-abortion. Nobody's out there saying we want to see more abortions. You know, we do want prenatal care. We do want sex education for young people. We do want birth control. We do want those things. And unfortunately, right. The other side doesn't seem to. So I think what you're saying is very true. Liberty, since you're more brilliant, please ask something.
You know, I think that you guys made some really good points about what we need to reach unity together. You know, especially I think it was you who talked about how we need to break out of the current vocabulary we're in. You know, that's so important because it's little things like that, you know, the details that Jimmy Carter focused on that are really going to create deep changes in our system. And yeah, I just think it's really important that we focus on that together, focus on that unity, having those conversations to see that we're not, there's no enemy in the situation. We really are trying to work together for the same goals, just in different variations, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I just wrote this book about Orrin Hatch and Ted Kennedy, who were constantly fighting because they were in the same, you know, they were alphabetically near each other in the Senate committees and so forth, H and K, and they were radically different, liberal and conservative, hardliners. But, you know, they got together and they did four or five fantastic things together because they did what you just said, broke free of the ideology, out of the straitjacket of these stupid binary choices that the social media has forced us into. And they together passed the Americans with Disabilities Act, the greatest civil rights act since the 1960s. Millions of disabled Americans suddenly had their own Emancipation Proclamation, according to disability leaders. That's what it was. And it's because Hatch convinced the conservatives, Kennedy convinced the Democrats and the liberals, and it got done. And they did that again on children's health insurance at the state level. They did it again on the Religious Freedom Act, which unfortunately kind of unraveled in recent years. But they did it on a whole range of issues. Even though they hated each other politically, they insisted on being friends in the Senate and seeing what they could do together. And, you know, the secret untold history of the Biden administration, if you look at the news every night, actually is that there was a golden age, a mini golden age, of bipartisanship in his first 2 years with a wide range of big legislation that he passed along with Republicans and along with Democrats, even on gun safety. They actually passed a not insignificant gun safety law, which is a tremendous achievement. And, you know, if Biden had been a better communicator, he would have been reelected in a shoe-in on the accomplishments that they had. But, Michael, I think that one problem that Biden and Harris had was they didn't have a good answer to the biggest question of all, which is how did you let in X million illegal or undocumented immigrants? How did you do it? Why did you let it happen? They had no answer for that. I thought that abortion would have checkmated that and delivered a resounding Harris victory. And I was totally wrong. And what happened, of course, was more Black and Latino voters and men, especially, than expected, voted for Donald J. Trump, which is an incredible achievement for Trump. And I pray that he surprises some of us in the center and left and does spectacularly good things. I don't know. But did you see the footage of him chit-chatting with Barack Obama as if they were good buddies? What did you think of that?
I thought that's politics, you know, that Obama understands it. And you know, we laugh about Trump, but Trump understands it too, because it's not that much different than business in that sense. You know, I went into politics. I'll tell you why I went into politics. I went into politics because I was the best salesman at everything I did. I worked my way. I've worked full time since I was 14 years old, and I was always the best at selling things. And then I graduated from college and went on to graduate school and understood, you know, and studied politics. And I said, what can I do to use these skills that I've earned to get you to buy a suit and tie or a luxury watch? What business can I go into where I need to use the same skills? And politics is it, right? And so that's what I thought of it. I thought that they were just being political. I don't think President Obama thinks anything of Donald Trump. And we know that Donald Trump tried to get him knocked out because he said he wasn't even born in the United States. How can you be up, you know, sit around and joke with a guy like that? Well, you can do it because you know a camera's on you and because that's the way politics works. But let me ask you about this thing with Orrin Hatch and Kennedy. We saw the same thing when I first started between Orrin Hatch and Tom Carper, who is a senator from Delaware, when they tried to put together a bipartisan package to give our delegate to Congress a vote. As people probably know, I never had a vote, and our delegate in Congress doesn't have a vote, in the House doesn't have a vote. But they came together in a bipartisan way again because I think that Orrin Hatch understood, as Carper did, that is the way you get things done. What do you think has led to this, if you want to speculate, on this great division that we have now in Congress where they can't seem to get anything done?
I think it's what exactly what Justice said earlier. It's shock and entertainment. Shock and anger are really entertaining. And in the personality of Trump, you already had an entertainer for, what, 8+ years on The Apprentice who creates chaos every day. That seems to be his current strategy, or has been for 8-10 years. It works. It's entertaining. It's good television, whether you hate him or love him. It's good television. Or it's like, you could argue that it's train wreck television if you don't like Trump. But it's riveting. And I think that if somebody were articulate enough or entertaining enough, from out of left field, it could be a recently retired 42-year-old Marine major who may or may not have served in combat. But if that person, if he or she was a centrist like Eisenhower and had policy positions that were technical, like Carter did, like nobody else. He campaigned on technical analysis and proposals on policy issues. That's why the American people have elected him. But if we had a new personality or 500 of them who came forward and took that approach, I think they could take over the government in a good way. Because I think that's what Americans want. I mean, you know, Trump had simple solutions. What's our biggest problem? Immigration. We're going to throw out the criminals, period. Next. We're going to, you know, take down the deep state that is invading everyone's privacy. Okay, next. We're going to stop the Ukraine. In other words, he has simple, entertaining solutions for issues that are developed with shock and anger, Justice said earlier, and it's a heck of a good formula. But I know that in this environment, that's how we got here. Basically, is the power of shock, chaos, and social media. But I know it can be mobilized for good, and I think that the example of Hatch is a good one. Where, you know, there's the D.C. statehood, D.C. representation. Is a critical issue that is rarely addressed in the national media, but here you have a leading senator, Republican leader, who naturally might not be a good friend of a predominantly Democratic city, trying to solve the problem. Why? Because it's a problem. It's an American problem, and it deserves an American solution. It's not that complicated. Right now, I'm in a nation. A small nation, it's large geographically, but there are about 6 million people here, Finland, a new NATO ally, that is the freest country on earth. It has a 100 index on freedom, according to Freedom House, which is a nonpartisan think tank in Washington, D.C. I think the United States comes in the 80 range or so. And the politics here can be nasty. It can be emotional. But it generally is very technically oriented and very multi-party that gravitates toward the center. And I think that's a natural American direction. And the more I have a radical point of view. I think that the highest form of patriotism for an American is to be humble with other nations, to learn from other nations, and to together with people around the world and diverse people inside and outside of our nation, do great things for the world. That's how we were perceived not that long ago, for example, in the age of John Kennedy, and in some respects in the age of Clinton and Obama and Reagan. And I think we've got to do that again. We have to inspire the world again, and we could do it tomorrow if we rolled up our sleeves and did it. And I think Trump might channel that in some way. He might channel a whole new direction for the United States. It's a bizarre thought, but he might surprise us all. And again, I pray that he does.
Me too. And I hope that Liberty's taking notes here, because if it takes charm and brilliance to make this happen, I hope you're getting your candidacy ready. You got any more questions for him before we let Mr. Doyle go? He's been so kind to give us his time. Do you have another question for him, Liberty?
I have no more questions, but thank you so much for coming on here and sharing everything you had to say. You brought up some really interesting points.
Yeah, I think I just want to reiterate that. Thank you so much. And we'll have to have you on again, because this is a discussion that we need to carry on. And we really didn't get into, you've done work on Ukraine and other things that we really love to talk to you about in the future, Mr. Doyle. We've had several people on the show to talk about Ukraine, including Zelensky's press secretary, who was a guest on the show. So we'd love to have you back. Thank you so much for your time, and I don't know what else to say. Thanks.
Great. Thank you so much. We'd love to talk to you again, Senator, and thank you so much, Justice.
All right. We'll make it happen. Now, I want to continue for a few minutes just to welcome our new co-host and just brilliant college student, Liberty Jones. You know that when I started this show 11 years ago, I started it with a friend of mine, Kathleen Gomez, who I'd like to give a shout out to because she just got elected supervisor in Arizona. Amazing. And Kathleen and I did it for a while, and then she had to stop due to other commitments. And I had a brilliant woman named Maria Sanchez, who, by the way, is going to come back on the show from time to time. And Maria was a Republican woman from California, and that's what I wanted. I wanted – we had a liberal guy from the East Coast, a Democrat, and a Republican woman from California, and I thought it'd be a good mix to find it because we have different perspectives. And then we had another amazing woman, Marilia. And Marilia is an old friend of mine, Marilia Duffels. She unfortunately has a very demanding life, so she was only able to do it for a while, and hopefully we'll have her back on from time to time. But that's why I wanted Liberty Jones. Liberty is a college student. She's already shown you how brilliant she is. I got to know her through my work, and I asked her to be on for exactly what I said. I said that, earlier that I think that how you see something depends on where you stand. And I'm going to say this one more time because it hurts. But a woman that's 50 years younger than I am absolutely has to see things differently, I believe. And so I'm interested in having this perspective. I think that our guest tonight pointed out that we need to make changes in the way we approach things as Democrats. We've lost women. We've lost young black men. We've lost young people in general. And I'm hoping that you, Liberty, can give us some insights into the ways that we might change to make things better. And I'd really like to hear from you what you hope to get from this experience.
Yeah, you know, I think that was a really, those are really beautiful words on your part. I think you really captured the essence of us joining together and what we want to do, which is to inspire, you know, our listeners to really see politics in a different way. You know, I think it's time that we move forward from the current streamline we're moving towards, you know, which is this race for popularity and power, and that we really settle down and we start, you know, looking at what we really want out of the system instead of what looks better. Right. And I really do think that it really reflects on each other's perspectives. You know, how much are we willing to put aside from our own perspectives to allow someone to teach us something? And I hope that's what we're able to inspire, is that unity into people, to be able to see clashes in perspectives, to maybe be able to take that in their own lives, you know, and find unity in their own lives as well.
Well, I'm starting to think this was a big mistake, because I'm going to end up being the co-host on your podcast instead of the other way around. And but I want to thank you so much, Liberty, for joining us. I look forward to having you on as much as I can. I respect the fact that you're a college student and you actually have a life and other things that you have to focus on from time to time. So I don't know if you'll be here every week, but if you can, I'd love to have you. And folks, I hope you listen to the brand. We're going to revamp everything. We're going to have this amazing young woman on. We're going to have some other guest hosts. And we hope that our show, which was nominated for People's Choice Award this year, will go on and be better and be a voice. You know, we're not in power right now as Democrats, but we still have a voice, and we need to be out there and we need to speak. So thank you to our Fulbright scholar, William Doyle, who was on the show, and to Liberty Jones, the amazing college student, which we hope we'll have over and over and over again. And we leave every week with a song. We play out with a song every week. And I think that the appropriate song tonight would be to Jimmy Carter. This is Imagine by John Lennon, sung by Garth Brooks and Miranda Lambert as they sung at the funeral of President Jimmy Carter yesterday. Let me say, in signing off, President Carter, it was an honor to work for you. I'm hope that you rest in peace and that you are one with God. I know that you are a man of great integrity, and you passed on to me the idea that we should all do what we can to serve each other. I know that I don't want to speak for Liberty, but I know her well enough at this point to know that I think she feels much the same. So tune in next week, and this is for you, President Carter.